This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. We've been talking all week about the disappearance of journalist Jamal Khashoggi, who was last seen outside of a Saudi consulate in Turkey on October 2nd. Turkish officials have said they have audio recordings that prove he was tortured and murdered. And today, in a pro-government newspaper in Turkey, some details of the torture were published. And the details are gruesome. They include severing his fingers during an interrogation before beheading Khashoggi and dismembering his body. Today in the Oval Office, President Trump called Saudi Arabia a very important ally and was asked about the audio recordings.
President, why would I tell you?
Have you asked for this audio video intelligence that the Turks
supposed We have asked for it if it exists.
Yeah. But you haven't gotten
it. We've asked for it if it exists.
Are you surprised that they haven't turned it over?
No, I'm not sure yet that it exists. Probably does, possibly does. I'll have a full report on that from Mike when he comes back.
The president there referring to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who visited with leaders in both Turkey and Saudi Arabia this week. In a statement, Pompeo said the Saudi leaders would investigate the matter and that they continued to deny any involvement in Khashoggi's disappearance. The incident has highlighted international concern over the Saudi regime's human rights abuses, and there have been reports of an increase of women and other activists being arrested and detained. This week, we're spending some time trying to better understand the United States' relationship with Saudi Arabia. Yesterday, we looked at the economic ties between the two countries, and today, we turn to their record on human rights. Sarah Lee Whitson is the executive director of the Middle East and North Africa Division with Human Rights Watch, and she joins me now in studio. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
Let's talk a little bit about Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Since he came to power in 2017, what's his record been so far on human rights?
Well, his record has been quite bad, actually, probably far worse than his predecessors exercising power in Saudi Arabia, because he has not only arrested and jailed activists who have been the traditional targets of Saudi repression, but he's gone far, far wider in an effort to consolidate all power in the country. So going after the business establishment, going after other royals who may have independent voices, independent bases of support, as well as the religious establishment, basically the pillars of the Saudi royal family's support, in an effort to wipe out any avenue of questioning of his own rule. In addition, he's launched a catastrophic war in Yemen, completely unnecessary war, launching thousands of airstrikes against the civilian population in the country, creating a humanitarian catastrophe that is now leaving 13 million Yemenis on the brink of starvation, according to the UN's report this week.
Let's talk a little bit about the humanitarian crisis in Yemen. What is Saudi Arabia's interest in that country?
Well, Saudi Arabia's purported interest in that country is to keep the country as its zone of influence, where it exercises close control over government in that region. Its stated reason for going to war in Yemen is to, it's somewhat funny to say, but restore the democratically elected President Hadi, who was overthrown in a coup by Houthi forces, allied with the prior president, now deceased. The real reason that many analysts believe that Saudi Arabia has gone to war in Yemen under the Crown Prince's rulership is that he wanted to have a quick military victory in Yemen as a feather in his cap as now the Minister of Defense, the new Minister of Defense, because among the many portfolios that the Crown Prince has amassed for himself in addition to Minister of the Economy is, of course, Minister of Defense for someone who has had zero defense experience. And so the idea was that this would establish his bona fides as a military leader with a quick victory to reassert control over a militia that had taken control over Yemen and show that he would be a strong regional leader. Saudi, of course, now claims that the reason was to avoid turning Yemen into an Iranian proxy state. But, of course, when they went to war, there was very little evidence of Iranian involvement in Yemen.
I want to turn back to what's happening within Saudi Arabia. And there have been reports, as we mentioned in the opening, of an increase in women and other activists who've been arrested and detained. Can you tell us a little bit about some of those examples?
Sure. So if you understand what Crown Prince has done from the perspective of an absolute and total concentration of power, and that any changes that are coming in the kingdom are coming by his decision and his decision only, by absolute fiat, it was important for him to jail women activists who had for years campaigned, for example, for the right to drive, in order to send a very clear message to Saudi society that they not get any ideas, that his decision to allow women to drive was his decision only, and not a result of civil society activism and campaigning. So it was really a very clear message to all of Saudi society not to get ideas that because he was making this reform, he was open to being swayed by civil society.
I'm speaking with Sarah Lee Whitson, the executive director of the Middle East and North Africa Division with Human Rights Watch. Sarah, I want to also let our listeners know that it's not just, we talked about Yemen, we talked about inside Saudi Arabia, but Saudi Arabia also has had some pretty high profile conflicts, if you will, with other Western countries that have taken issue with its human rights abuses. And I'm thinking about Canada, for example. Can you give us a little bit more on that?
In response to the Canadian foreign minister's, I think, merely tweeting about the continued detention of a blogger in Saudi Arabia named Raif Badawi, who was sentenced to 10 years in prison and thousands of lashes, which they've since ceased implementing because it was just too embarrassing when the inevitable camera would capture him being lashed by Saudi officials. Because he is married to a Canadian resident, someone who's sought citizenship now in Canada, the Canadian government has spoken on Raif's behalf. The response to that from the Saudi government, from the Crown Prince, really reflects his rather impetuous, impulsive, angry impulses, was to try to punish Canada by withdrawing thousands of Saudi students studying there, Saudi citizens seeking medical care there, and threatening to cut off business ties with Canada, as well as recalling its ambassador. You know, I think, of course, part of it is to send a message to other states of the punishments that Saudi Arabia will exercise should they criticize the country's record, should they criticize the country's violations. But really, I think it was just also a reflection of his erratic nature in lashing out in a way that really only created far more attention to what the Canadian foreign minister had said than would otherwise have been the case. And so what we've consistently seen from the Crown Prince is impulsive, impetuous, acting out like a five-year-old toddler who doesn't get his way.
You know, one of the things that we talked about yesterday on the show was our economic relationship with the Saudis. And I'm wondering, given all the history, and there are many more examples that we haven't gotten to yet, but why is it that the United States remains so closely allied with Saudi Arabia? I mean, is there anything... even when we're seeing the response to Khashoggi's disappearance, right? It's sort of hedging to see what ends up happening. Can anything actually be done to push back on these human rights abuses, given this very close economic relationship?
Well, absolutely. And I think it's very important across the board to separate American business relationships, transactional relationships, from our diplomatic, social relationships with abusive governments. First of all, the U.S. should not itself be implicated in abuses, which it currently is with respect to the war in Yemen, not only because of its supply of weapons to Saudi Arabia, American bombs, have been documented by Human Rights Watch and other organizations to be used.
And the president has suggested that he probably will not implement any arms sanctions or arms deals, you know, if that's one avenue. So the arms sales look like they'll continue.
Well, I don't know that they will necessarily continue because Congress has a say and has a voice in this. And they do have the capacity to condition arms sales. And they have the capacity to raise the costs for what we've seen from the Secretary of State's waivers of those conditions. There does reach a point when it becomes unsustainable to continue with arms sales in the face of atrocities that are receiving widespread international attention.
Are we close to that point?
Well, we've come close to that point repeatedly in Europe. Germany suspended arms sales. Spain promised to. The Netherlands has suspended arms sales. You know, they are jigging and jagging back and forth, but clearly the pressure is there. You know, these are all, you know, this is not just to sanction Saudi Arabia. It's to avoid implicating Americans in war crimes. It's to avoid creating the conditions that will naturally create blowback from Americans. And we've seen that over many decades, that when the U.S. is implicated in terrible abuses in the Middle East, Americans then become targets of retaliation. So it's a national security interest as well.
You know, there's also the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has also been trying to recreate the image of Saudi Arabia, given all of these human rights abuses, and make it more seem like it's more of a progressive and modern country. What has that looked like so far? I'm thinking women being given the right to vote, the right to drive. Right? Is that one example of that?
That is one example of that. Women in Saudi Arabia have now joined the 21st century with the abolition of the restriction on their right to drive, as well as the promise to open movie theaters, which is considered a revolutionary move in 2018 in Saudi Arabia.
Is a lot of this optics, though, or is it real change?
No, I think it's certainly real. You know, when women take the wheel, it means they have some freedom of movement. And the ban on their driving was 100% about controlling women's freedom of movement. So women in Saudi Arabia still can't travel without the permission of a male guardian. And Saudi women who've managed to escape Saudi Arabia have found themselves facing threats of abduction, attempted abductions, and actual abduction by Saudi government officials who've literally dragged them back to the country. And so it is a loosening of that restriction. And I think it's a smart move by MBS to tap into the majority of his population who are under the age of 30 and who don't understand why their country is so behind the times in these basic things. That's extremely embarrassing. When people talk about Saudi Arabia, the number one example they would always give is that, well, women can't drive there. So it's taken that talking point away at what has turned out to be very minimal cost. For decades, the Saudi government's defense for continuing to create this ban on women driving was that the public would revolt against the government if they changed it. He has called the bluff of all of those threats as to why Saudi can't make changes. And so certainly now we want to see other changes, like lifting the bans on women's right to marry. Women can't get married in Saudi Arabia without their male guardian's permission.
Sarah Lee Whitson is Executive Director of the Middle East and North Africa Division with Human Rights Watch. Sarah, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
As the story of disappeared Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi continues to unfold, we now turn to the perils faced by journalists all around the world, especially women. There was Kim Wall, age 30, a freelance journalist, murdered while reporting aboard a submarine off the coast of Denmark and then dismembered. Daphne Caruana Galizia, age 53, investigative reporter and anti-corruption blogger in Malta, murdered outside her home by a car bomb. Victoria Marinova, age 30, investigative television journalist in Bulgaria, raped and murdered by blows to the head and suffocation. Each of these murders took place over the last 2 years in Europe, away from major conflict zones. These journalists were not caught in crossfire, they were targeted, losing their lives at least in part for being journalists or for being women in high-profile jobs. 2018 is on track to be a more deadly year than last year. So far, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists, 62 journalists have been killed. Men make up the majority of that number, but some say that doesn't reflect the atmosphere of danger for many women in this line of work.
It used to be the case in hostile environments that if you wore the words press on your vest, that that would be some kind of protection. It would afford you protection. Now it seems that having that kind of badge on your chest actually makes you a target.
That's Jody Ginsburg. She's the chief executive officer of Index on Censorship, a freedom of expression nonprofit. I asked her about Kim Wall, Daphne Caruana Galizia, and Victoria Marinova and the work that they were doing.
So in the case of both Victoria and Daphne, they're both investigative journalists. We don't know yet whether Victoria was targeted specifically for her investigative work, investigation into corruption. We know that Daphne was the target of repeated threats for her work investigating corruption at the highest levels of government and business in Malta. She was killed a year ago yesterday. And she was targeted in a number of ways, including through legal threats and others, repeated criticism of her work. In the case of Kim, she was murdered whilst doing a report into a submarine and the inventor of the submarine, and killed while on board that submarine.
What are some of the unique challenges and dangers that women journalists face? Do we understand why we're seeing journalists, female journalists, being targeted in general?
So what I would say is it's not clear that female journalists are targeted disproportionately because they're journalists. I think what we've got to look at here is the way in which women are targeted disproportionately with threats of abuse, threats of rape, harassment, doxing and the like across the board, not just in journalism. Now, the thing about journalism is that women in journalism tend to be relatively well known. They're high profile journalists. I am a journalist myself. We need to be in the public eye. We need to be known to people so that they feel that they can approach us with stories. Our bylines are on newspapers. Our pictures are known to people if we're broadcasters or on television. So people are aware of who those women are, and whether they target them because they're journalists or because they're women is less clear. I think what is clear is that people are increasingly feeling able to have a go at journalists, in part because of the environment that's been created by politicians and others in criticizing journalists publicly, and that the public in general, and largely men, feel that they are able in particular to target women with really nasty threats. And we are certainly seeing that on the rise.
Tell us a little bit about the role here of social media in particular.
Sure. So obviously in the past, it was more challenging to contact journalists. You had to write a letter or even call a journalist. Now it's much easier to target people in general. All of us put our profiles often out there in the public. So it's easier for people to get in touch with us. They don't need to know our phone number. They don't need to know the address, our home address or the address of the newspaper. They can contact us almost directly. What that's done, on the one hand, I think the internet has been a great thing for journalism and democracy in general. It's enabled those who didn't have a voice previously to voice their opinions, their concerns, their criticism. But also what it's allowed people to do is feel that they can publicly berate, criticize, and in some cases abuse and harass people with whom they disagree. I think it's less clear how far these abusive messages online translate into any real intention to commit violence. We heard about the three women that you mentioned, but it's unclear how far the people who are sitting in their homes feeling that it's fine to abuse women online actually have any intention of carrying that out. Nevertheless, it doesn't stop it having an impact. It's easy, I think, for people to say, oh, just suck it up, ignore it. But that ignores what it is like to be on the receiving end of hundreds, thousands of messages threatening you and your families. And I think that's something that we don't often talk about. It's not just that some of these threats, real or not, to women are not just about saying, I'm going to attack you, I wish you would be raped, and so on. It's also that often people's families are threatened. And that gives anybody, male or female, I think, great pause about how far they want to carry on.
You know, what's interesting is that the three cases we're talking about here all happened in Europe. And I'm wondering if that tells us anything about what the environment is like for journalists there.
I think it does. I think one of the things that we have noticed most in our monitoring of media freedom in Europe in recent years at Index on Censorship is the way in which the environment has changed for journalists generally. And I think in part that's because politicians, those in power, have enabled that environment. We have the President of the United States, but not just the President of the United States, a number of politicians throughout Europe who are openly voicing criticism of the media for anything that they don't like, enemies of the people, fake news. And that creates an environment, I think, in which the profession is devalued and which in which people then feel that journalists are fair game.
Jody Ginsburg of Index on Censorship, a freedom of expression nonprofit, has joined us talking about the dangers to journalists, in particular women. Jody, thanks for being on The Takeaway.
It was my pleasure.
This week, the Trump administration named Mary Mayhew as head of the National Medicaid Program and the Children's Health Insurance Program, also known as CHIP. Previously, Mayhew served as Maine's health commissioner, overseeing the state Medicaid program. But throughout her tenure, she's led efforts to prevent Medicaid expansion, championing narrower eligibility standards and leaving fewer people with access to coverage. Here to talk about what Mayhew's appointment means is Dan Diamond, a healthcare reporter for Politico. Dan, thanks for joining us on The Takeaway.
Very glad to be here, Tanzina.
So let's talk a little bit about Mayhew's history with Medicaid in Maine. What were some of the reforms that she put in place specifically that restricted access to Medicaid?
Mayhew, under Paul LePage, a longtime ally of Donald Trump, he's the Maine governor, worked to cut down eligibility for Maine residents to sign up for Medicaid. What that means is folks who had incomes that previously were able to qualify for Medicaid, that threshold was lowered. She also rolled back eligibility for drug subsidies for elderly patients, and at the same time did other reforms to the food stamp program. As a result, there were thousands and thousands of people, about 80,000 people, in fact, on Medicaid who moved off the program while she was in charge. Her defenders would say that's great. She was getting people off of a state program. She was reducing spending. But her critics, and that includes many patient advocates that I've spoken with, would say that she put vulnerable patients further at risk. And those are arguments that I think we'll keep hearing now, as she now takes this job in Washington.
What about Mainers? How did Mainers take to that decision?
I don't think they liked it very much. You could see that both in the popular opinion polls about what was happening in Maine, as well as the fact that Mayhew herself ran for governor this year. She finished third in the Republican primary, casting herself as a successor to Paul LePage. The measures that they point to, Tanzina, measures like hunger went up while Mayhew was even rolling back the food stamp program. And that's the kind of tension that has really concerned the advocates on the ground that I've spoken to.
Now, what do we see nationally? Because as she's overseeing Medicaid nationally, do you think she'll be able to implement those types of restrictions at the national level?
It's telling to look at both what she has said in the past as well as what the Trump administration has already put in place. So I was reading a letter that Mayhew sent to the Trump administration about a year and a half ago, where she laid out all of the things that she wanted in Maine. Her wish list included work requirements for Medicaid beneficiaries, essentially that healthy adults would have to get a job or show that they were pursuing one. She wanted to set lifetime limits of 5 years, on total Medicaid eligibility. And she wanted Medicaid beneficiaries to pay some premiums. Now that she's in this job, she will be receiving those sorts of applications from people across the nation, from state Medicaid directors, and she will be in position to either expedite them forward or push back. There are people in the Trump administration who have similar views to Mayhew. Her current boss, a woman named Seema Verma, has also been very receptive to these sorts of requests. But the fact that they have added Mayhew will make it easier to move them forward.
And are there, briefly, are there concerns about the CHIP program as well?
The Children's Health Insurance Program is tied up in this, too. The fact that there are funding issues for that program have generally been patched over by lawmakers in both parties, but there is significant fear that Mayhew will look for ways to cut that, too.
Dan Diamond is a reporter for Politico covering healthcare under the Trump administration. Dan, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tanzina.
Today's podcast is sponsored by Babbel. People around the world are learning new languages with the Babbel Language Learning app. Learn Spanish, French, Italian, German, Russian, Swedish, and more with Babbel's 10 to 15 minute lessons. You'll learn through interactive dialogues, speech recognition, and fun trainers and quizzes. And in a few short weeks, you can be speaking a new language with confidence. And Babbel is available as an app or online. And right now, you can try Babbel for free. Go to Babbel.com and download the app and try it for free. That's right, Babbel, B-A-B-B-L-E.com, or download the app to try it for free. Babbel.com.
We turn to Florida now and the aftermath of Hurricane Michael. Whenever a natural disaster hits, vulnerable communities can often be forgotten or left behind, and the disabled community is no exception. Last week, Oscar-winning actress Marlee Matlin, who is deaf, tweeted out a video of the storm's trajectory with this comment. I wanted to share this video for the thousands of deaf and hard-of-hearing residents in the path of Hurricane Michael, but unfortunately, it's not closed captioned. Access to info is vital. It's a life-or-death matter. So what can be done to improve on these communications failures for Americans with disabilities? Marcy Roth is the CEO of the Partnership for Inclusive Disaster Strategies, and she formerly served as FEMA's Director of the Office of Disability Integration and Coordination. Welcome, Marcy.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
So, Marcy, in her tweet, Marlee Matlin described a failure to provide closed captioning during Michael. What are the federal guidelines for how communication needs to share before, during, and after an emergency or natural disaster?
So it's required that information is provided equally to people who have those legal protections of disability, which includes people who are deaf, people who are hard of hearing. Information must be provided during emergencies that is actionable and accessible to everyone.
So what do we know about how people with disabilities do during disasters? Are they more at risk? Are they more likely to be left behind? Are they more likely to be discriminated against?
People with disabilities are 2 to 4 times more likely to be injured or to die in a disaster. And it's almost never because of their disability. It's because of a failure to plan and be inclusive of their needs and the needs of the community in accommodating everyone.
We're obviously reporting on the aftermath of Hurricane Michael. I'm wondering, what was your assessment of the situation on the ground there for the disabled community?
So we are still very much at the front end of disaster response, and circumstances for everyone have been dire. For people with disabilities, circumstances have been especially difficult. The ability to get actionable information has been stymied because communication systems are down and people don't have television. Text messaging, thankfully, is still working for many people. But if you don't have power, then you don't have the ability to keep your phone charged. Unfortunately, we have heard that many people who have evacuated have not found that the shelters are prepared to meet their disability-related needs, forcing them to hospitals, and those hospitals are overcrowded and unable to meet basic needs for people who don't need acute health care. It puts people with disabilities in tremendous jeopardy, and it's a huge misuse of those very limited local community resources.
You worked in the federal government as FEMA's director of the Office of Disability Integration and Coordination. And I'm wondering, given that experience, do you see areas of improvement in emergency and disaster program management, specifically for the disabled community?
When I was at FEMA, Administrator Fugate led a charge to build capacity for providing qualified disability experts on the ground to support the state and local response. We had been charged with bringing together 285 qualified disability experts, and we were on the way to building that. We had well over 150 folks. Since that time, we know that right now in Florida, there is only one disability integration advisor on the ground. And in Georgia, there is no one specifically working with the state of Georgia. So the ability to provide that qualified expertise is just not in place.
Marcy Roth is the CEO of the Partnership for Inclusive Disaster Strategies, and she formerly served as FEMA's Director of the Office of Disability Integration and Coordination. Marcy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
50 years ago this week, Tommy Smith and John Carlos raised their gloved fists as they stood on metal podiums at the Mexico City Olympic Games. It was the summer of 1968, and their protest, a symbol of black power and civil disobedience, rocked the world. Here's Smith at a press conference after the ceremony.
The right glove that I wore on my right hand signified the power within black America. The left glove my teammate John Carlos wore on his left hand made an arc from my right hand to his left hand also signify black unity.
50 years later, we're seeing a renewed wave of protest in sports, most notably with athletes taking a knee during the national anthem to protest police brutality and social injustice. According to a recent NBC Wall Street Journal poll, 54% of voters say kneeling during the anthem is inappropriate. But that hasn't stopped athletes at all levels, from pro sports to high school programs, from participating.
That's why I'm so passionate about this, because I have a grandfather that's a veteran. I've talked to him, and he supports me in my decision of kneeling. It's to a point in this nation where people need to see the problem and either need to be a part of the solution or they're a part of the problem.
Richard Johnson II plays left tackle and defensive end on the Capital Christian football team in Maryland, and he goes by RJ. And before the season began, he and his teammates organized and decided that collectively, all 32 players would take a knee before each game. And Cornell Wade is RJ's coach.
I think one of the great things about the protest in terms of what goes on with us is that I take a knee right next to Coach Fair, who is a retired Marine who stands at full attention. And I think that's a great representation of what America should be, where, you know, I can have my opinion and I can voice my opinion and I can have a fight that I feel is worthwhile and someone else cannot. And we can disagree on that. And that is okay. So while people may feel like it is inappropriate, what I would like to see is a situation where people are understanding of the deeper meaning behind it. This isn't an issue about a flag at the end of the day. This is an issue about the fact that, you know, I'll send players from this school and I'm not sure whether or not they'll make it home when they leave this school.
I asked Coach Wade how their team first came to the decision to take a knee.
When they first approached me about it, I definitely was proud that they wanted to take up a fight, if you will. I'm a firm believer that you stand for something or fall for anything. So seeing them decide that they wanted to, you know, stand up for a cause that they thought was worthy gave me a sense of pride. I just gave them two things that they needed to make sure that they did. The first is that every one of their teammates agreed that they wanted to do the protest or would support the protest. And then the second was that they did it in every game and didn't pick and choose when they did it.
RJ, this thing about taking a knee actually started two years ago with Colin Kaepernick. I'm wondering, when that happened, what was your reaction? How did you feel about what he was doing?
I personally remember sitting down with my parents and watching that news article that I believe it was that week it happened. It was shocking because it made me realize even more what the problem in this country was. And then just seeing all the backlash that he had within the week of him first kneeling, it was a sad reaction, but it also made me hungrier for justice.
And when you say justice, what do you mean?
I mean justice for all the innocent lives that were lost to police brutality. As a Christian and as a man, there's certain morals that you have to uphold. And you need to be able to take care of everyone. Because I know if I had a son, I wouldn't let him do anything because I'd be too worried about him doing something.
Are you all having conversations about this in school?
Yes. This school is a very politically active school, and we are very politically aware here.
RJ, when you know, this week is the 50th anniversary of Tommy Smith and John Carlos, who raised their fists at the top of the podium in Mexico City at the Olympic Games. Had you ever heard of that protest?
Yes, ma'am. Oh. I've seen the pictures of it. And my family, my great uncle, who actually recently just passed, he was very active and he made sure that I knew a lot about civil rights.
So do you feel like that influences what you guys are trying to do on the field now?
Obviously, it obviously does, because I know that the older generation in my family, they've told me stories of how they had to struggle. And they've told me horrible stories about what people have done to them or tried to do to them or done to their friends. And it just, it, like I said, it, it makes me hungry for justice in this nation. For my family to have to go through that, and then for us to basically just be going back to the past.
What about you, Coach Wade? When you look at the 50th anniversary of Juan Carlos and Tommy Smith at the Olympic Games, and you look at what your students are doing, how do you feel?
Again, I'm just very proud of them. I'm happy to be able to support them. I feel like athletes definitely have a platform and that it should be used. And whether you talk about the Olympic Games or, you know, Muhammad Ali when it came to going to the war, even to now with Colin Kaepernick standing up against police brutality, athletes have a platform, and I believe it is not only their right, but I believe it is our duty to use that platform in order to bring about change. So I get a great sense of pride when I see these guys do that. And, you know, I feel like they are trying to actively make a change in the world. They're not just sitting around talking about it. They're not tweeting about it. They're actively being a part of a fight that they feel is worthy. And for me, like I said, I'm just so proud of them. I can't tell you. They definitely give me hope for a future generation.
Coach Wade, do you worry about what happens on the road? Is this the team that travels?
Yes, we travel quite often. There is a certain level of concern just because of what you see going on in the world today. There's been a level of confidence when it comes to acting a certain way that didn't really exist before this current presidency, at least that I was exposed to. You know, I've always had experiences with racism, even going back to college, but it's a lot more prevalent in the sense of how it's displayed now. So, you know, you always have that level of concern, but I'm a firm believer that it's in God's hands. And I was brought up, you know, by a family who believes in God and believe that God's will be done. Nobody's will is greater than his. So we don't really worry about it too much. But there is always a certain level of concern in making sure that they're safe.
We're also seeing a big wave of activism just across the country when it comes to young people. And I'm wondering, RJ, if you or any of your classmates are planning on becoming more politically active by voting when you're able to. I would assume that's about a year or two from now.
Yes, I have already registered to vote. I'm only 17 now, and I have registered to vote, and I plan on voting. And I believe most of the other seniors, like I said, this is a very politically active school, so I believe most of the seniors have, not just football players, but most of the senior class, if they've had the opportunity to, they've registered to vote, and they're ready and willing to vote. And I know personally that we have talked to the younger players on the football team about voting and its importance.
Richard Johnson II plays left tackle and defensive end on the Capital Christian football team in Maryland, and his coach is Cornell Wade. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
And as always, we want to hear from you. When was the last time you participated in a form of protest?
Hi, my name's Sherry Smith. I'm calling from Tualatin, Oregon, near Portland. And I have done a number of political things in the last year. But probably most importantly, I took my 11-year-old daughter to our state capitol here in Oregon and had a very heated conversation with our local state representative who just did not understand why we would need to keep guns out of the hands of more domestic violence, convicted domestic violence abusers and stalkers. And it got pretty heated, and my daughter was pretty proud of her mom and learned a lot about how politics works and what it means to object and try and do it respectfully. And that was probably one of the more important political actions I've taken recently. I'm also trying to get people out to vote and quite a number of other things. Thanks.
Hi, this is Karen Zacharias calling from Redmond, Oregon. And the last protest I participated in was the march against Kavanaugh. In some ways it works to raise your voice, but nothing changes until the authorities begin to get violent.
Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Again, 877-8-MY-TAKE. Find us on Facebook. Find us on Instagram. Find us on Twitter. Thanks so much for talking with us. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.